Let's do some review. Yes. Quick review of the whole shebeel. Darkness, flood, prison, Holy Spirit, house. They've been the main themes up to now. Darkness, flood, prison, Holy Spirit. I've said that a million times, but just to prime the pump. And now we're on the chapter of the earth. The big image in the chapter on the house was that there was the light of the sun and the moon in the house. That was so important because the textual allusions in Auroric Insurgens came from biblical quotes referring to God. So the house was the house of God. What we would expect to find in that house was an image of God, but what we found was an image of the union of the sun and the moon. That's the big deal. I came across a marvelous dream that shows the same thing, and I thought I'd read it to you. You don't get many of these dreams where it's so absolutely clear. This was in that book I mentioned at Bonfrance. Juan Francis' last book, it was The Clearing of the Enigmas. And it's just so beautiful and so beautifully illustrative of this point. I thought I'd read it to you. She writes, this is page 47, "The following dream illustrates how love plays a vital role from the point of view of the unconscious. This dream comes from a middle-aged woman. For conventional and rational reasons, she hadn't been able to come to terms with a deep love she was experiencing toward a married man who also loved her." So it's a triangle. "I heard the mighty sound of a bronze clock. It was an exceptional sound. I have never heard or imagined it. A sound from the beyond, of exceptional beauty, irresistible. Fascinated, I got up because somehow I had to reach the source of this sound that had to be godly. As the sound seemed holy to me, I thought it could come from a church. Immediately, I found myself in a church of pure Gothic style, made of white stone. I got ready to climb the tower to find the bell, the source of this rhythmical, solemn sound I was hearing. Everything around me changed. The church became a vault, like the nave of a cathedral made of transparent, living red material. It was bathed in a reddish light and supported by a forest of columns, which reminded me of the stalactites I had seen in some caves in Spain. For a while, I saw myself very small, standing alone in this enormous hall, surprised at the fact that I was to investigate a whole new world. It was my heart. I was standing inside my heart, and I realized that this magnificent sound which I still heard was the beating of my own heart, or that the outer sound I was hearing was one and the same as my heartbeat. They were identical and beating at the same rhythm as the heart of the world." So see there, the church becomes the heart, and the heart now apparently is the church. And that's very, very similar, I think, to the meaning of the union in the house of God. But Franz just mentions a couple of sentences, which I'll read you. Won't read the whole interpretation because it's pretty obvious. "But the dream, I believe," she says, "needs no interpretation. It speaks for itself and shows how eros and individuation are linked together. The fact that the heart beats in the same rhythm as the universe tries to bridge the existing conflict between the outer and inner world, which plays such a great role in our love relationships and has even led many religious movements to reject the outer fulfillment of love completely." So there you can see how that's also the Aurora theme, the Sophia theme, that the inner and outer are the same, and by addressing one, you're addressing the other, and by addressing the inner, you're addressing the outer. But as Jung points out, it would be just as wrong to affect a haughty spirituality as a pretext for evading the deeper outer human responsibilities, as it would be wrong to drag a relationship down to a primitive, atavistic, I mean, instinctual level. One has to find a way between these two. that I thought was just a beautiful example of the fact that the image of God is changing. You see it in this text, and now you slowly see it, that when you're in the church and you think you're about to have a religious vision, what you see is something very non-typical. The other main image of the house chapter was the house anointed with blood. And that got us into the idea that blood has to be put back into the material. That led to a discussion of the three stages of the conjunctio, which I'll just briefly summarize, and hopefully it sounds familiar. If it doesn't, why holler? But the first stage is the separation. Second stage is a union. And the third stage is a union with of that union with the world. Does that all sound familiar? Unio mentalis, the first, unio corporalis, unus mundus. We'll be seeing that throughout the whole shebang. The last point I felt was very important in that three stages of the conjunctio, and that is this unus mundus, that you begin to see not only that you're working on the inner world, but the outer world comes to repeat the same images. And I also mentioned that the outer world comes to meet you, so that when you're ready to take the step in the outer world that you have been preparing for inwardly, the world comes to meet you. And sure enough, I had an example of that this week. My Pegasus friend. By the way, I wanted to just correct one slight error in the phrase that was at the bottom of the Pegasus symbol and the Pegasus word. I said eight times I fall down. It was eight times I am knocked down. Makes it a little stronger. Yeah. Eight times I am knocked down, nine times I get up. Well, she called me again, sure enough, after this seminar, and she said, you'll never guess what the next installment of the Pegasus story is. She's just about two-thirds of the way through this MFA in screenwriting at UCLA, and is just terrified about how the future is going to, how's she ever going to make a living? I mean, it's one thing to have an MFA, but in the competitive world of Hollywood, how do you get scripts published? And secondly, she's got a conscience, and she also knows that you do better if you write fluff. Feeling also a little bit that the teachers at the school kind of pump you up, and she worries that she's not getting accurate feedback on these scripts that she's writing. They have to write maybe three or four scripts a semester. Through a sort of series of coincidences, she met a guy who is a successful screenwriter. I guess that Spielberg is reading his scripts. I mean, he's that good. I don't think he's got any on the screen, but these producers buy the scripts, so they have the rights to them. Because for them, it's nothing, $100,000, $200,000 for a script. If they're making hundreds of millions, this is small potatoes. So he's sold a couple of the scripts, and he's making a living as a writer, and agreed to read her scripts and give her honest feedback, agreed to sort of introduce her around to the writing market, and asked her to read a script of his. Guess what it's on? Oh. Oh, no. Why don't you do it here so you can hear what I'm saying? It's the story of Perseus and Medusa and Pegasus, and it's a modern reweave of that myth. So it just goes to show you how this stuff works. And I thought that is so clear, because what she really, and she has said to me, what I need is a friend here. I need somebody who's not going to just, doing this because he's trying to seduce me. The guy's happily married. I just need somebody to be a mentor to my writing, and how do I break into this market? And the market came to her. And when it did, it came on that very same thing. So that is one of the clearest examples I have seen. And believe me, this person is suffering. She's going into debt. She's had a vision that she wants to write. She's following her dream, so to speak. And then after having been thoroughly tortured inwardly with doubt and guilt and debt worries, then the world comes. on exactly the very same thing. So that's how this stuff works. And this struck Jung so much that when you're working at a deep level, there's this resonance between inner and outer. And see, the rationalist thinks, oh, I must do X, Y, and Z to get to move forward in life. And that is not untrue. You know, this an example of my friend. She is, you know, she has taken many steps with her willpower, like leaving, she's from the South, leaving her friends, buying a smaller car, living humbly. There are many ego steps involved. But at that moment, when you're working on your individuality, Jung's observation is something else happens, and it just does not happen inside. It also happens on the outside. And this is a realization that came to him, I think, rather late in his life. I mean, he'd sort of known it. And then when he met Pauli was saying, oh my God, you know, do you realize how important this is, Jung? And then Pauli's the reason that Jung published his essay on synchronicity. That was really Pauli's idea to go public with that stuff. So at the end of Jung's life, and then I think this book is in that spirit, what is the nature of reality? That inner work is not only inner work, it's also inner and outer work at the same time. And you see, that contradicts every assumption of our worldview. So that's why I think this book is so terribly important. You don't see it so clearly very often as that, where that the world literally came to her and on exactly the theme that she's been struggling with within herself. And you see, that to me is what the religious task is. That's the union of theology and psychology. It's living your own individual life, both inwardly and outwardly. And it's the sacred work. There's no difference. Her life is her sacred work. The other thing I wanted to mention too, very briefly, just with the Sophia. And again, this is nothing new, but I think keep hearing it again, hearing it in different context, will help you see why do we distinguish this one aspect of experience and call it Sophia experience? What's unique about it? How is it different from traditional understandings of divine revelation, for example, or what the sacred is? I think two things we've said again and again. I'm just repeating them in the context of what we've been talking about. Two things are, one, this convergence of inner and outer. Often it will start with an outer, with a desire, either a sexual desire or an antipathy with respect to the outer world. It starts in emotion. It starts in affect. And it also ends in emotion. It also ends in the material world. That's what we'll be talking about today. So this inability to distinguish between the inner and outer world, I think, is one of the key aspects of the Sophia experience, that the material reality is as spiritual as a Gothic cathedral. The other quality, which was implicit, and I wanted to mention it when I read the dream, but I forgot it. I'll just go back to it for a second, is that these things are always or very often accompanied by a mess. Sophia experiences are messes. That was a love triangle. And I thought of Jung's comment when somebody asked him about his spiritual life. This is what he wrote. This is from the Letters, Volume 1, page 492. I wanted the proof of a living spirit, and I got it. Don't ask me at what a price. I wanted the proof of a living spirit, and I got it. Don't ask me at what a price. So the price is that emotional complication that comes along with the Sophia experience. In Jung's case, it was a love triangle. And everyone who is, I think, honestly trying to individuate in our time has one of these confusing bouts to deal with. And at the beginning, it looks like it's thwarting your way. But by the end of it, you realize it was the announcing of your way. And, of course, it takes an enormous amount of humility to accept this very lowly beginning of your spiritual development. So two aspects of the Sophia experience there. Then we went on to the next chapter, with the chapter of the earth. And I said when reading a chapter that's this confusing, what I try to do is I try to go for the main idea. And I've tried to sum up the main idea, and we'll have to see if it makes sense throughout the whole chapter. But why is the chapter of the earth coming up now? Because it has been missing up to now. That might be a way to put it. We've had the earth as the beginning of the experience. But as far as Thomas's own personal life, he never lived that. He's seeing in his unconscious a vision of the psychological profile of our age. And for him, this essentially physical, this process which has this physical and confusing beginning is stays an intuitive perception. So the reason the earth is coming up now, so over here, is because it's showing him that this experience needs to be made real. And even though the ego is not in a position to understand this, that as far as the unconscious is concerned, that doesn't matter. It figures its job is just to generate the whole sequence of the process. So it just keeps on churning up the next image after the next image after the next image. Whether you get it or not, it really doesn't matter as far as it's concerned. It keeps doing its work. And you see this in some people who simply cannot or will not absorb the meaning of that inner process. When it gets to the end, it just starts again. So it has its own sequence, and that is what, of course, Jung means by archetype. An archetype is a typical sequence of steps. So even though Thomas hasn't really been able to swallow what's being put, the unconscious will keep showing him what would be the next step, what would be the next step. And the next step is then taking that vision and making it real. So that's why the earth. We saw that in the previous chapter in the blood and the rock. Same idea. Make it emotionally real in your life. And the house is a very similar image. Another way to look at that is that this experience isn't, I'm not going to say it. This experience is a sequence of possible steps, but those steps don't really mean anything until they've been made real. So that at each point, when you have an experience of this particular stage in this series of steps, it seems like this is the most basic reality of them all. If you go back to the Pegasus, when she was in doubt and she saw the Pegasus truck, the experience was to her, yes, this is a fundamental truth of my life. So in that sense, it's earth. Going ahead now, when this guy actually comes and introduces himself and is willing to introduce her around, she's having the feeling, yeah, this is the most fundamental fact of my life. So each of these experiences, when they're made real, seem like the bedrock of your life. I think that's another reason why the house, why the earth image appears, because when it is made real, it seems like the most fundamental thing to you. Another reason I think the earth comes up is that it's the beginning and end of the process. So it starts with the earth, and then it ends with the earth. Starts with the earth in that you find yourself in an emotionally complicated situation. That's the beginning of the Sophie experience. And, if you didn't have earthly desires, you'd be free from having to have this experience. But because you've been true to your earthly desires, and you have gotten into this mess, the psyche starts generating for you the process which not only leads you out of the mess, but leads you into yourself. Of course, they are really two different ways of saying the same thing. And then the process isn't finished until it becomes real and reality itself begins to cooperate. So that's why it starts with the earth and ends with the earth. That's how I've tried to sum up. She's going to say a bunch of different possible interpretations of the earth. It's probably going to mean just about everything by the time we get done with it. But that's simply because there are many dimensions to this experience in it becoming real. That's how I've tried to summarize it to myself. I tried to sum up the different meanings she has given to the earth, and I haven't got through the whole chapter, but this will get us going. I mentioned these last time, so I'm just repeating. The earth will mean the unconscious. The earth will mean the mystery of life. And I found one I wanted to put in there. I didn't mention this last time, but I think I'd add that because I'm still trying to understand this myself. The earth as the body. That's the third. And then the fourth would be the earth as prima materia. The fifth would be the earth as unio corporalis. And then the earth as God. And the earth as human.
What was the last one?
Earth as human.
Human.
One last detail. Apokatastasis. I did a little work on apokatastasis because it's such an important word. What von Franz says that this parable is a kind of a, or this chapter is a kind of apokatastasis. First of all, I looked up the word in the dictionary. Apo means separate. Kata, C-A-T-A, means back. And stasis means stand. So it's traditionally, I was right, it is traditionally interpreted as restoration. Restoration in the sense of going back as a separate individual and standing again. That's how I would understand it. I thought I'd read you what Edinger said. He does such a nice job. It's only a couple paragraphs. The reason I'm focusing on it, Jung uses the word quite a bit, and he gives all the references in here, which I don't think we need to worry about. But as you can see, it's so closely related to our concept of the self. So when she says this chapter is an apokatastasis, I just wanted to spend a little bit of time on that word. Here's Edinger. It's from the Ion Lectures, page 46. Apokatastasis is a term Jung was fond of. He uses it quite a few times in his works. It is important to understand the word, as it leads to, I love these phrases when he says it, because he doesn't say it very often, an understanding of the essential nature of Jungian analysis. The word shows up only once in the New Testament, Acts 3:19 and following. Peter is speaking to a crowd of people, and he's quoting now Acts. Now you must repent and turn to God so that your sins may be wiped out, and so that the Lord may send the time of comfort. Then he will send you the Christ he has predestined, that is Jesus, whom heaven must keep till the universal apokatastasis comes, which God proclaimed speaking through his holy prophets. And then that's from the Jerusalem Bible, by the way. And Edinger goes on. This is not the word that is usually used in English translations. The usual word is restoration, till the universal restoration comes. But we will use the original word apokatastasis. Jung refers to the use of the term by the prophets for the return of the Jews to their homeland from the Babylonian exile. The restoration of the temple was referred to as an apokatastasis. In another place, Jung suggests that Paul may have acquired the idea of apokatastasis from his Hebrew teacher, Rabbi, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Rabbi Gamaliel the Elder. Jung describes the rabbi as a Jewish Gnostic, and suspects that Gamaliel may have taught Paul the old tradition about paradise, that after Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden was no longer any good, having been damaged in the same way that the image of God in man had been damaged. And for that reason, God moved paradise into the future. In the future, there will be a messianic age and a return to paradise. That will be an apocatastasis, a return to the original ordering of things. The term apocatastasis corresponds to the Platonic idea of anamnesis, or what is called recollection. Now, anamnesis is what it's the word we use for taking a personal history. It's a medical term to take an anamnesis. I think it literally means a remembering, a recollecting. Jung uses the term anamnesis in the Platonic sense that as we acquire consciousness, knowledge, all our learning is only a remembering of prenatal knowledge. All our cognition is no more than a recognition, a remembering of what we once knew and had forgotten. I know some of you will like this. We find the same archetypal idea in T.S. Eliot's poem, Little Gideon. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time.
Amnesia might come from that.
See, amnesia is a forgetting of the anamnesis. Yeah, but knowing the place for the first time, that's apocatastasis, becoming that person that you were born to be that we talked about. And just a couple more sentences. He goes into the same word in the archetype of the apocalypse. This is page 171. Psychologically, we can understand apocatastasis as the ego's restored relation to the self. That's the most concise summary I've seen. Ego's restored relation to the self.
Okay.
So that's what she's saying this chapter is about. It's the psyche generating images of the ego's restored relationship to the self. So when that man came to my friend with this offer, you see, inner world, outer world were the same, and that is a step in the production of who she was meant to be. Archetype of the Apocalypse.
Oh.
Page 171. So psychologically, we can understand apocatastasis as the ego's restored relation to the self after a long period of estrangement. The whole period of ego development from infancy to maturity involves an elaborate estrangement from the original complete relation to the self, which nevertheless had one rather sizable defect. It was unconscious. So that at childhood there was a unity with the self, but it was an unconscious unity. And through education, through parenting, through the demands of reality, you lose touch with that. Hopefully, with as little violence as possible, and bad parenting is the parenting that really separates that. And good parenting, however, is still going to lead to a separation because you have to function in reality. But then the task later in life is to come back to that self consciously. This coming back to the self consciously, he writes, I believe is the psychological background of the grand image of the restoration of all things.
All that latter stuff from the
first part was from Ion Lectures, page 46 and 47, and the last part was from Archetype of the Apocalypse, 171.
So, would that mean that the more people that got into this, the more they would be, since you mentioned paradise?
Yes.
Okay. That we ourselves could bring it back, if all of us.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to admit, every time I work with somebody and I watch the efforts the unconscious goes through to give them the invitation back to their self,
mm-hmm.
and they funk it, I think there's one more reason the bomb's going to go off. It's like you can just see how hard the unconscious is trying to bring us into ourselves. And the foolishness that goes on in politics and social intercourse is by people who have no relationship to the self. Because that self is packed with good judgment. And I guess the hidden hypothesis within Jungian psychology, one of the hidden hypotheses, is that if enough people become aware of this self, maybe history can take a somewhat different course. Yeah, I think so. All right. And let's see. So that was the first main point she made on 339 in the new chapter. The whole bottom of 339 over to 340, the whole parable appears to depict a kind of apocatastasis. Hopefully that makes sense. And again, we're not saying anything new, but we're going back and hearing these same ideas in different ways, and hopefully they begin to sink in, not just to the way you think, but the way you feel and the way you can envision what life's to be about. The other point that we talked about, and that's where we left off, was the from the text, the bottom of 340. He that cometh from heaven is above all. And that was a reference to the Emerald Tablet. Also, by the way, I needed to correct myself. I said the Emerald Tablet is one of the oldest texts, and that's not true. It's really hard to find a date for the thing. I guess most people say between 200 and 300 AD. And it looks like what they're calling the earliest alchemical text is from about 350 BC. But anyway, it's old. And in that text, the opus is described as the creation of a body on earth which rises to heaven and then descends again. And that is an early representation of this alchemical idea that the work starts on the earth and then goes into, for lack of a better word, a spiritual dimension, a psychic dimension, we might say, but then ends back on the earth again. And as that Pegasus chapter, next chapter in the story shows, the earth comes back transformed. You might say doors open where before they were shut. The world behaves in a different way, and that's what she felt that text was alluding to when the thing rises and it comes back. Of course, where does it come back to? It comes back to the earth, and our chapter is on the earth. So it's trying to show that not only is the person transformed, but the outer reality is transformed in just the way they need to put their skills and talents and love into the physical world. Because without that putting it into the physical world, you see, this is all just autoeroticism. That's the great danger of psychological work. It just stays inside yourself, and you never take it back and share it with the world. And that's where we left off.
One thing that occurs to me is, you know, one of the things that separated Jung as a mythologist is he said that the physical world didn't show the psyche something it didn't already have. All the forms were in place before they actually expressed in the physical world. Most mythologists would say they saw what was out there and then they created an inner psychic world based on what they saw. And Jung was one of the first that said, no, that's not true.
Right.
The archetype of the hero, the archetype of the way the cosmos was set up, we came with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's interesting is that what I'm hearing you say is that then so we had it in our minds and we set it up in the world, but now the world is showing us it's in it too.
It's in it too, absolutely.
It's not either or.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's the synchronistic part, which
that's
is just, part. It's sort of, that's the part of Jung's work that needs to get grown on. I mean, I think he started
absolutely.
It at the end, but that's the piece.
I agree totally.
Because they split, mythology split in terms of how it works.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he, as far as I read him, he knew this. You know, you've heard me break Jung's life up into four stages, you know, up to 13, his learning psychiatry and Freud, and then 13 to 28, his Night Sea Journey, and then 1928 to 1944 is when he did his nuts and bolts research, and then 44 to the end is when he wrote these late works, Mysterium Ion. I think what he started to do then was go back and look at the philosophical implications of what he had just said. He'd said it, but you know how you can say something like, I just want $1 million. I just want $1 million. He sort of said, oh, there's no split between inner and outer, and there's no clear distinction between time and space and the unconscious, and the outer world is just as psychic as the inner world is just as material as the outer world. And then he goes, what? What did I just say? And that's where Pauli walked in and said, yeah, you just said that, Jung, let's work on that. And yes, he only gave very provisional understandings of that, and I think it's up to the next generation to pick it up and work on it. I think Aurora is you know, von Franz's contribution to that. Number in Time was a contribution to that. Probably Psyche Matter, all that's probably a contribution to that too. And to me, the issues it raises is, one, what's the nature of physical reality? It raises the question, what's the nature of science? It raises the question, what's the basic error of Western epistemology, Western understanding of understanding? Is there a way to, this particularly interests me, is there a way to re-understand what political and social service is? Because you can see, now this woman is meant to be a writer, I think, but suppose she'd been meant to be a politician. I think it works the same way. Everyone's got a task. And for those people whose work it is to contribute to the outer world, and by now you can see that Jung feels the outer world is just as important as the inner world, how would that look if we had a conscious politician? What difference would that make in the physical world? These are all questions that are raised. And, you know, another question would be the relationship of the body to psychological growth. Well, that's Mary Goodman's work. Also A. McGuire's work. So it opened up a whole door of questions, which I couldn't agree more, is now our job to begin to articulate. And, you know, if you'll pardon me, I get pretty frustrated with a lot of my colleagues when you read what they're taking of Jung. They're taking the 19th century version of it. And they're saying they're moving on, this whole fascination with Kohut and Kierkegaard. It's all 19th century metapsychology. There's subject and object. There's ego. And you never get this idea that there's a mystery going on, which is both psychic and material. And this isn't some flaky New Age concept. You see it making differences in real people's lives. And that's where hopefully the future generations of Jungians will pick up and go with. I think it's terribly exciting. And it's Sophia insofar as that's what Sophia is. It's historically relevant because, as we've seen, Thomas's unconscious material is really addressing our age. So this is the beautiful challenge of our time.
Isn't it also fair to say, though, with the people like Kohut and that subject-object, that's the work of the first half of life.
Yeah.
You have to be able to separate in order to see it. So
yeah.
It doesn't matter what your parents did, that was your path to consciousness, because you have to, then the uniting comes once, the integrating, the wholeness comes once you can separate.
Yeah, I think they're valuable tools, but they become worldviews.
And then I think we're going to eventually grow past it. The more of us that come to it, the more we'll begin to see the wholeness of it all. I think it's a necessary tool in this step.
What I see in my colleagues is they stay stuck there.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying that I think that's the first half of life work that we all need to have. It's not where we need to end up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have no problem with them as tools.
Right.
But if you listen, see if you don't hear that they have become worldviews.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a mistake. And why? Look what my poor friend went through to get that guy to come to her with his Pegasus script. I mean, I spent many hours with her on the phone thinking, saying, I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't think I'm going to make it. That's what you have to go through if you want the spirit to guide you. That's what Jung says, you know, don't ask me at what a price. And if you live in a rationalistic model, you're spared all that. You do it yourself. Well, you do something yourself, but if you, whether you ever can get back to the true self and to find the self's place in the social events of the time, in the outer world, I don't think you can do that without a miracle. And if your model doesn't start with the miracle as its base, how do you ever help anyone get there? That's my two cents. And that's why I think this book is so very important. And it's what certainly von Franz knew and what she was working on. And you saw it in that dream of that woman whose heart and church were the same thing. But again, think of what guilt she was carrying to have that happen. So that took us to .342. I'm afraid we're going to have to go slowly because this is not easy stuff. I'll read you the quote, and then I think I'm just going to read you selected passages, and let's see if we can understand what she's saying. As the prophet beareth witness, in the beginning, O Lord, thou didst found the earth, and the heavens are the works of thy hands. That is, water, air, and fire. For from the earth are the elements separated by dying, and to it do they return by quickening, for what a thing is composed of, into that must it be resolved. Well, you see, again, there you got three in one, right? Earth, you got water, air, and fire. And then earth, as mentioned, as the beginning and end. Because it the other three are composed of the earth, and they return to it. I'll read you what she says, but sometimes I try to just stop when I read something and think, now how would I put that in my own words? And it goes to what I was trying to communicate earlier, that this earth is the basic fact. If you can go back to the Pegasus, the latest installment in the Pegasus drama, what the psyche is aiming at is that there be a story written in time and space. That's the end point wished for by the self. And the way it does it is it creates confusion in that very same time and space to initiate the process which ends up creating a new work in time and space. Does that make sense? It starts in time and space. It's almost like the self knows that it wants something in reality at some future time. And so at this moment, in that very same reality, it generates the mess. And so all the stages that we have seen up to now, the flood, the prison, blah, 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 they're the in-between between the first manifestation of the self as a problem, which was arranged because of the self's foreknowledge of what it wants created at the end point. So in that sense, it's basic. It is not, what it is aiming for is a change in the course of history. That's my words. Might be a little more... of a bit more of a modest scale to say it wants a change in the events of your community. So you see how the personal self and the collective self are two aspects of the same coin, two sides of the same coin.
Could you also say it's asking for a broken consciousness?
Yes.
Wanting increasing awareness?
Yes, definitely.
Of what's already there?
Yeah, and I just would add a little bit. Well, let me give you a sentence I had in a dream once. See if I can remember it. Creativity is the psychological aspect of the evolutionary process. Now, we know that we physiologically evolve, that there's a physiological evolution. But I think there's also a psychological evolution. And creativity is the way that it tries to get human culture to evolve. By human culture, I mean the way we understand ourselves that sets the stage for the way we act. So you can't just look at the self without looking at the larger context. Because what it ultimately is asking you to do is participate in the human story, participate in human events, and add your contribution to them. But the way that then works is it works in each individual by creating a situation where you are both the consciousness of the self. But then what that's aiming at is ultimately your contribution to the bigger picture. And what it really wants you to do is to do something different in the world. And the key word there in this chapter is do. That's the earth. Now, certainly you have to understand differently before you can do differently. A silly example, and you know, I freely admit that I am just trying to understand this myself, so I don't presume my ideas are anywhere final. But I'm trying to remember who it was in Greek history, so you might help me with this. The birth of democracy in Greece started because one day a archon, I think they were called, said, let's have elections. It went from a monarchy to a democracy because one person said, I don't want all this power. I want to set up a system of elections. Now, admittedly, it was a very limited democracy. But you see how one individual did something differently, and that affected the course of history. Now, we're not all going to be great leaders who make great decisions, but in our own small way, this is what the self is aiming for. This is why the Earth chapter, to do something different for the evolution of humanity. And maybe it might just be coaching a little league team consciously or teaching fairly. But that's what the Earth is involved here. And this process is not finished until the person does that thing in and on the material world.
And oftentimes it messes with an inflation?
Well, with a mess.
Well, you should include inflation.
Well, which generally brings it down.
Okay.
Why do people like to sit in the back of my flank here? I always know. Sorry.
Got your back.
Pardon me?
I got your back.
I know you got my back. That's what worries me.
This is comfortable on the couch.
I can see what I'm dealing with. It's true. I'm not referring you to it all, believe me. But I have noticed in workshops, the troublemaker comes in last. And they sit right at my chest. No, I'm not referring you to it. I mean, when I'm out at a public gathering, and I'm, you know, at the first 5 minutes, you're wondering, is there going to be trouble in this afternoon or not? Mm. That's where it gets you.
Make friends with your flank, huh?
Well, watch your flank.
Watch your flank. Keep an eye on your flank.
Okay. Let's take a break. Well, now we have a bit of time. That clock's a little bit ahead. Let's read after the passage. Here the author, besides praising the earth as the mysterious arche of the cosmos, the arche is the source, right? And it's praising it as the arche because it's the earth is where the elements came from. As the of the cosmos and the basis of all life, introducing a curious new idea. That the foundation of the heavens above the earth, or the creation of the world by a sundering of the upper from the lower, is a death. So that's a separation. And then in consequence, the dissolution of the world and its return to the undifferentiated arche signifies a renewal of life. Strangely inverting the Genesis story, he presents the creation as a process of destruction, and the destruction of the world as a reunion, not a dissolution, but a fusion with the original unity. I'll try to put that in your own words.
The Grail legend. It's the kingdom suffering a death, and then greater consciousness, greater awareness.
Yeah, how does that look in the individual, though?
Well, in the individual, it comes on as a depression or a loss of interest or meaning in life, and all of a sudden you're looking out and the landscape doesn't hold meaning for you as it did. There's like a separation from it. So you experience it as a death.
Yeah. I think what she's driving at here with respect to the specific Sophia thing is that confusing beginning is felt to be a death.
Right.
Maybe like what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do. You feel like you're dying. Almost
you feel like
a
you're
physical
dying.
Death.
You feel like you're dying, right. Right.
And this is what?
The beginning of the process.
Okay.
You see, you start off with the unconscious self. And what the psyche knows is that ahead there is a conscious self. And in order to bring itself into that future state, it generates the confusing emotional drama that you've landed in. Now, we've seen aspects of this experience is that it knows where it's going, right? That's the spirit aspect. That's the air. It comes with great emotional confusion and suffering. That's the fire aspect. It comes in a state of you feeling dissolved. That's the water. So that earthen beginning of the confusing emotions generates the end point by creating wind, spirit, water, dissolution, dissolving, and fire, emotional suffering. That's what the text is trying to describe metaphorically. Yeah.
Does this keep happening? Does it keep kind of rotating? Like,
yeah, sure.
Like you think things are going well, and then you get this, you know, like nothing's right, you know, things mm-hmm. like that, and then you start feeling positive again, and but you know it's going to come knock you off your feet again.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I do think it's like the first time you go through it, it's a vaccination. And you may be exposed to the process again, but you're able to
recognize
it and cooperate with it so that its effects are not so disruptive. Mm-hmm. So again, Earth, as the generation, Earth generates the experience to produce something on the Earth, and it does so by creating water, fire, and wind. And I've just tried to explain to you how I understood Earth. I'm sorry, not water, fire, and air as dimensions of this experience. But again, the whole point is that something happens on the Earth. Let me read the last paragraph, then we'll take a break. The next paragraph. Destruction of the world, that is when the confusion hits you, when the elements return at death to Earth, is psychologically a symbol for the complete extinction of consciousness. And accordingly, it often appears in dreams at the onset of a psychosis. Of course, we know a psychosis, in the best sense, is meant to be a period of reorganization. We know from the earliest parables that the author must have been in a state bordering on complete dissociation, in which his conscious world was at least totally disrupted. But in contrast to a pathological dissolution, the psychic hierarchy seems to have built itself up again out of the chaos, so that the destruction of the world, or the return of the three higher principles, the heavens, spiritual spheres of consciousness, to Earth, the unconscious, in it is an individuation process signifying the birth of a new transcendental cosmos. So the point of all that, I think, to summarize it up for yourself, is that the Earth means the unconscious. The unconscious, in the sense that there is something in us generating the beginning confusion to produce the final end state by means of the emotional chaos, by means of the spiritual guidance, and by means of the loss of orientation, which would be the dissolving aspect of the water. So, main point again, how important the Earth is to this process. That's what I've been trying to stress today. And what large spheres it begins to border on. You can't just talk about it personally. It becomes a social, political issue, because the psyche is bigger than you. Okay, that's a stretch. No, that's okay. It's hard for me to hear and talk to my back. That's fine.
You know what's starting to occur to me around this is that whatever is coming in many people, it tends to land in a few people who carry the broader message. So, huge things like Jesus, there were a lot of itinerant preachers back then who were beginning to talk about the same thing. And for some reason, that's all part of this plan that unfolds, that it bubbles up. So I would say your experience of anxiety when you go out and talk because the message is so new and threatening means that it's coming in a way that people that have to be after it. So it's not coming to a single individual. It is coming in various ways. But for some reason, it's somebody's destiny to be the one that carries it in a certain way that's very threatening.
Yeah.
And they suffer even more than those who suffer because they suffer publicly in ways that people don't who aren't actually the carriers of the public message. It's almost like enough energy.
Yeah, it's sort of like little nodules surface at certain places, and it's the same stream, and it just bubbles up at certain places.
Exactly.
Jung, I think, was certainly one of them, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he suffered a lot.
Oh, God.
You know, it was a very difficult life, but he was one that he carried so much for the rest of us.
Yeah, he's still being attacked for it. Like Edinger will say that he thinks Jung is the new point of view, and I have always felt, well, he was just one place where it surfaced.
Yeah.
It's surfacing in other places.
You can't stop there. I think that's always the mistake we make, to say this again.
Yeah.
And it's what I love about kind of mythology. Mythology is nothing more than a belief in the way the world is. But that's not a stagnant thing. It's always growing. If consciousness grows, we grow. And it's both exciting to be on the edge of that, and it's hard.
It's exciting and painful.
Because not a lot of people want to have these conversations.
Right.
Rather shop.
Shop to use up.
Or whatever. Bring.
Well, as my friend in L.A. said, you know, everyone wants their candy.
Yeah.
Everyone wants their candy.
Yeah, it's a very interesting world out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a two-tiered world. There's a lot of people at my school that are from their scriptwriters who want to do a better job, who know something, and they want to somehow have a conversation about it. So she's in a good place, as much as it feels difficult.
I think she'll make it.
Oh, how awesome to have the affirmations that she's getting.
Yeah, but she's $100,000 in debt. And what job do you apply for with an MFA in screenwriting?
Yeah, you don't. Peck away at it, you know. If she can take any comfort in knowing that those stories are the stories of all people who do good, great things, you know, rarely does somebody come through.
Yeah, 8 times I'm knocked down.
I'll look forward to seeing what she gets up on the screen.
Me too.